Jim W. from Fresno, California, taped at the monthly intergroup speaker meeting in Fresno, California, on Friday, May 14, 1993. In observance with the 11 traditions stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all AA speakers.
It's now my pleasure to introduce the main speaker this evening. He's the treasurer for Central Office, and he's now serving his second year as treasurer for Central Office. Please join me in welcoming Jim W.
Hi, I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you all hear me? Good. Maybe. If I were in charge of the format here, this is what we would do. I would talk for 10 minutes, we would take a 25-minute smoke break, and I'd come back and talk for 10 minutes more. But I'm not in charge. I also had a dream about getting up here and talking to this meeting. I had this dream last night. And first of all, I dreamt that there were only a handful of people here. And with my ego, that was very disappointing. And secondly, I dreamt that halfway through, those that did come got up and left. So, with that kind of background, I'm a little apprehensive. But here we go. First of all, let me welcome the newcomers. The one thing I really hope tonight is that you will hear some little old thing that will make you want to come back again. That's what it's all about. Those three little words, keep coming back. Well, going back to kind of the beginning, I was not a battered child. I wasn't an abused child. I was never the victim of molestation or stuff like that. On the contrary, what I really was a spoiled brat. And I did not have a truly dysfunctional home, whatever that is. But what came out of my childhood was a very confused child. And I'll tell you why. My family background is Southern Baptist. And I don't know what you people know about Southern Baptists, but they don't believe in doing anything that's fun. First of all, of course, they don't believe in drinking. They don't believe in smoking. They don't believe in dancing. They don't believe in playing cards. They don't even believe in going to movies, because at movies they show people doing these things. And my grandmother and grandfather on my father's side preached this to me constantly as I was growing up, that all of these things were bad. And they did a lot of talking about God, but the God that they talked about, as far as I could figure out, had only one purpose, and that was to punish sinners. And I could see myself as a sinner all the way, because everything that they thought should not be done, I was doing. Now, with one exception, I didn't like drinking. My father was a complete renegade from this Southern Baptist upbringing. My grandmother managed to influence a certain amount of the family, but my dad rebelled when he was a young man. So in our home, all of these things were going on, and really to excess. However, my dad had this very peculiar idea that no one should drink or smoke until they were 21. Once you were 21, all the barriers went down. You could do whatever you wanted. But those first 21 years, you were supposed to refrain, because at that time, you know, the law said it was illegal for somebody to drink or smoke if they were under 21. But in our household, I was raised in a scene where every night was a cocktail party. We lived in a small town. My dad opened the bar at home there at 5 o'clock, and everybody in that small town that liked to drink showed up. The drinks were free, and they never ran out. And as a little kid watching all of this, it disgusted me. It really did. I was not allowed to participate in any way. And I remember night after night sitting back there in the kitchen thinking, you know, are these people ever going to leave? Are we ever going to eat? It's misery around this joint. And because of that, my father was an alcoholic, a functioning alcoholic, all of his life until his death at age 67. But I had real resentments toward my father. I carried them really and truly up until the point that I did a fourth and fifth step in this program and got in touch with my relationship with my father and saw how I was wrong. And I was wrong. I purposely did things to hurt him. I purposely did things that I knew he disapproved of in every aspect of my life. And he could never give me enough. Whatever he gave me, I wanted something better. And he gave me a lot. Totally ungrateful kid. Just a disgusting young kid. So anyway, this went on till I was 17, and at age 17 I went off to school, and I went to the University of California at Berkeley, and I'd been there about 2 months, and this was in 1946. There were a lot of veterans back from the Second World War. They were quite a bit older than I was, and a bunch of them said one night in November, they're going over to the city to do the town. To San Francisco, would I like to come along? And I said, sure. I didn't even know what that was, doing the town in San Francisco. But I went along, and I know that we started out at the bars, and in those days it was pretty easy to get a drink even though you were underage. Everybody had false IDs, and it worked. And I didn't know what to drink even, really. I never paid attention to how my folks mixed drinks or that kind of stuff. And I remember somebody saying that probably what I would like would be a Singapore Sling. So that's what I had, and I liked them. I liked them a lot that night. I liked them so much that I don't remember anything until waking up in my bed where I was supposed to be the next morning. Total blackout. Now, you know, most people, if that was their first experience with booze, they probably would have said, you know, this stuff must not be good for me. I probably can't handle this, and I shouldn't touch it. But that wasn't my reaction at all. I actually remember that by 5 o'clock that afternoon, I had a couple of beers, and I hadn't even had more than a half of a beer in my life. And all of my college years were a lot of drinking, lots of drinking. As a matter of fact, I ran into a friend of mine from college a couple of years ago. We hadn't seen each other in a long time. And he said to me, he said, you know, the way we drank in college, it's a miracle we didn't all end up alcoholics. And I mumbled, well, some of us did. Anyway, you know, I got through those years, but there were lots of blackout occasions, but I don't know, the Berkeley police were good to us, you know. We would get stopped in our cars dead drunk, and they didn't take us to the police station. They just sent us home, walking or otherwise. They were enablers. That's what they were. And I got out of college and got a degree and all that kind of stuff. And then the Korean War was on, so I had to do something. I decided I would enlist in the Navy rather than get drafted in the Army. And they had this most peculiar program where you could go and in 4 months you became an officer. I mean, you didn't know beans from Shinola about the Navy, but all of a sudden you were an officer. And that's where I was. I graduated from school back at Newport, Rhode Island. I was assigned to a ship and went straight to Korea, and I was on that ship for 3.5 years. Well, the Navy is a good bunch of drinkers, too. I had some real hair-raising experiences in the Navy. I'll just tell you about a couple of them because it's part of my story and it's part of the miracle that I'm even alive. Our ship had come into Mare Island up in Vallejo for repairs one summer. And one evening, another officer and I went up to the officers' club and started drinking. And we drank and we drank and we drank, along with a lot of other people there. And here again, I don't remember anything until waking up in my bunk on the ship the next morning. And I got up as best I could. I went out on the deck of the ship, and there was an officer on duty, and he said, "My God, what happened to your car last night?" And I'm a blank. I don't know what happened to my car last night. I didn't say that. He said, "Well, there it is out on the parking lot." And I looked out there, and this brand new car was absolutely smashed on all sides. The top was caved in. I mean, it was virtually totaled, and I didn't have a scratch on me. The other fellow that was with me, apparently he was, we really didn't know who was with who. We never knew who was driving. Never knew anything about this accident. That day we made kind of a quick tour of the naval base to see if we had done some damage somewhere. And we couldn't even find any damage to any property. Well, I will tell you that, you know, those are some hours out of my life that are just a total blank. I don't know anything about them. That's only one of a series of accidents. I'll tell you about a couple of more as we go along here. I got out of the Navy after my 3.5 years, and I got married 1 week later. My wife and I settled here in Fresno, and we proceeded to have 4 children in 6 years. And it was a very, very busy household. And I was working all of the time and working hard and supporting my family. And according to my standards, I was being a good husband and a good father and all that kind of stuff. And the fact that on occasion I drank too much was excusable. In other words, you know, I worked hard every day, and I had all of these little kids to fuss with, and I had to go to all these little league games and to piano recitals and dance recitals and all that stuff, and I was perfectly entitled to go out and get drunk once in a while. That was my vision of things. And that's exactly what I did. I can remember, you know, lots of blackout evenings. When I would get up the next morning, I could always judge what kind of person I had been the night before by the mood my wife was in. You know, if she was going around humming with a little smile on her face, I could assume that, well, I must have behaved last night, although I didn't know whether I did or not. If when I got up she was screaming and shouting, then I knew that obviously things had not gone well that night. And there were lots of mornings like that. But my wife, she's a good enabler too, because, you know, she never said, "Jim, you got to quit drinking." She said a million times, "You know, you got to take it easy. Just have a couple of drinks like I do." And so, you know, she stuck with me all of those years, and she's still with me. It's a miracle, too. During those years, I led a double life in a way. I used to go off on business trips, and I really had about 2 hours of business to take care of, but I stayed 3 days. And the rest of that time was devoted to drinking and carousing. And I did that periodically, and this I got away with. I never got caught up with on that score. It was kind of a double life. I got in some really neat situations in San Jose, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento. But, you know, always lived through them and got back home. I remember one time I had to go to Los Angeles on a business trip, and I was flying down there, and I had drunk so much the night before I got up the next morning, and I was still in a haze and on a dither, you know, I couldn't think straight, and I absolutely couldn't pack my bag. I couldn't get my head thinking what I needed to take, and it was late. I was going there for 3 days this time, so I got in the car and ran to the airport, and I did not take one thing with me, not a thing. And when I got off the plane, my daughter was meeting me, and she said, well, you know, where's your suitcase or something? And I kind of mumbled something about I needed all new clothes anyway, and so I'm going to do some shopping while I'm here. Oh, you know, a lot of crazy stuff. But, you know, I bungled my way through those years without any serious difficulties until about 1980. And in 1980, all of the kids were out of the house. And I don't know, I felt like now it's time for Jim to do what he wants to do. His responsibilities are over now. These kids are all off on their own. So I decided I would do what I wanted to do, and what it turned out that I wanted to do was to drink. So at that point in time, I became a daily drinker. And the compulsion to drink with me was so strong that I absolutely planned my whole life around my next drink. I can tell you what my daily routine was. I got up and I went to work at 8:30. I watched the clock, and at 11:30 I headed out of that office for lunch. And when I went to lunch, I ate at a bar, most of the time the very same place, and that's when I started drinking. And I would have two or three martinis before lunch, and then I would have wine with my lunch. And if the people I was having lunch with, if I didn't want them to know how much I was drinking, I would go have a martini someplace else first, and then I would go meet them. Common practice. Maybe two. So, you know, they saw me have one and assumed this is what was going on. I then would get back to the office usually about 2:30, and I scheduled any appointments I had in the afternoon for like 3:30 to 4:30. And I would kind of take a nap and doze off, and then I'd see people for about an hour there. And then I would drink a lot of coffee, and I would try to arrive home at 5:30 looking perfectly sober. And most of the time, I got by with it. Once in a while, I didn't look perfectly sober when I got home. Most of the time, I did. And the first thing I would do is suggest to my wife that we have a drink together. And she was very agreeable. She liked to have a drink in the evening. She used to say to me every now and then, you know, I don't understand why when we sit down to have a drink or two together that I don't get drunk and you end up so drunk. Well, there's an easy answer to that. There's a very easy answer to that. First of all, I had already established a good base for the drinking when I got home. And the second thing is, I was the bartender. And you know what that means. You know, she had a vodka tonic with 1 ounce of vodka in it, and I had a vodka tonic with 6 ounces in it. And I would have my two. Anyway, I had all kinds of shenanigans I was pulling on her, and you know, kind of getting by with a lot of them. Reached the point where she told me that she really thought I ought to just drink white wine. You know, lay off the vodka. And I said, that's okay, I'll do that. I like wine, and it's fashionable now. Everybody's drinking wine. So I started buying Inglenook white wine by the gallons. But, yeah, literally. But I still had the martinis at lunch that she didn't know about. But at home, I was a wine drinker. So this went on for a while, and I had a friend I liked to drink with a lot. And his wife's a real good friend of my wife. And I have to say, unfortunately, he's no longer with us. He died 2 years ago. But I was at his home one evening, and I thought he had become one of these white wine drinkers. And he was in his little bar there fixing his drink, and I happened to kind of watch him there. And I saw what he did, and he had this nice, big, large wine glass, and he filled it half full of vodka, and he put ice in it, and then poured wine over the top. And I said, Tom, is that good? And he said, yeah, it's really good. Try it. He said, and you know the neat thing about it, your wife thinks you're drinking wine. So I started doing it. You better believe I started doing it at home. I was a white wine drinker. That came close to doing me in. But there was another new invention that came along that really was neat for me. And that's when they started selling those mixed drinks in little cans. In the liquor stores, they put them in the cooling box, and when you bought them, they were ice cold. And I discovered those things, and I had tried, you know, just sitting around in my car drinking hot vodka. And I did it, but it really wasn't that much fun. It didn't taste that good. But those little drinks in those cold cans were excellent. Very expensive. I didn't like that. And I also thought they didn't make them quite strong enough. But the nice thing about them was, you know, you could go in and buy three or four, and then you could go park in the parking lot at Fashion Fair and have your cocktail hour there in the car. And, you know, I found a lot of people and things to blame for my drinking. And you know, I blame and for the fact that I became an alcoholic. I mean, you know, it was my friend Tom's fault for showing me that vodka and wine drink. And it was the fault of those manufacturers who started putting out those small cans. I mean, those are the things that did me in. It wasn't my fault. No way. Don't you believe it. Anyway, I thought that I was having a lot of fun drinking. I honestly did. I can tell you about some incidents that occurred, and you would certainly wonder why I thought I was having fun. But, for example, and I just read in the paper where the city is going to close the place, condemning it, but I ended up at a motel here in Fresno one evening in a virtual blackout, and what happened to me there was I got robbed, I got beat up, my car was stolen, and you know, that was my idea, I guess, of the fun that I was having drinking. They're closing that place down. If all of the customers there got treated the way I did, they should. I support the closure in every respect. Aside from incidents like that, though, you know, when I came into AA, I was very offended by this word insanity. because I certainly didn't consider myself insane, and I didn't consider my way of thinking to be insane. I look back on it now and I see how insane I was to think that things like that were fun. What finally got me here to AA was another accident. Happened just a little ways from here. 11:30 in the morning. I had been drinking at home most of the night and even into the early morning. I guess I got up with such a hangover that I started out with a couple of screwdrivers at home at 7 a.m. And at the time I lived way up in the hills at Lake Millerton. I drove down to Fresno. I was going to go to work. But I stopped at, I think it's called the Foursome Club. It's out here on, if it's still there, out on Clovis and Kings Canyon. And this was probably at 10 in the morning or 10:30, and I had a couple of martinis there. And I left there and I went on to another spot that you could walk to. And I had another one there. And at that point, I had decided, I got in my car and I was going to drive on to work. But something told me that I had had too much to drink and I better not go to work. So I turned around on Clovis Avenue and headed back north. And the next thing I remember is just a massive collision, shattered glass everywhere. The next thing I remember after that, I'm in emergency at St. Agnes. And virtually in a blackout, I truly don't remember the accident. Obviously, I had nothing to do with picking out the car that I hit. Everybody that walked into the emergency room for hours, I thought, oh my God, those are victims of my accident. They're here. And if they knew I was the one that done it, they'd kill me. Well, I learned sometime later that I had hit a parked car. And there were witnesses who said I was going 60 miles an hour. I totaled both cars. And I spent only 12 hours in St. Agnes and walked out with a few minor bumps and scratches. Now, at the same time, about 3 days later, at the intersection, I think, of Clinton and McKinley, there was a fellow driving along in the same condition that I was in. He hit a car and killed 4 people. And I followed that case, and he's gone to the penitentiary for 14 years. And, you know, I look at our two accidents. I had nothing to do with picking the car that I hit. Why I'm not there and why he's not here is something that I had nothing to do with. To me, it is truly a miracle. It was the power of God working in my life for some reason. He decided that I should be here and that that man should go to the penitentiary. I pray for that man. I sometimes feel like he took my place. And I wish him well. I hope he'll find AA in the penitentiary. Anyway, I got released from the emergency. I went home. And the next morning, with a bunch of encouragement from my wife, to say the least, encouragement, she suggested that I call a friend of ours who we both knew was in AA. And I finally picked up the phone and called him. And what I have to say after that is that I am the grateful victim of one of those old-fashioned 12 steps. Because at 1 o'clock that afternoon, he and another fella came up to my house to see me. Now, I was upset right off the bat because I didn't say anything about bringing somebody along with you. I was going to tell my friend what was going on, but I wasn't going to tell some stranger. Anyway, they came in, they sat down, they brought one of these big books with them, and, you know, just started sharing their story with me and got me talking. And we talked till about 4:30 or 5 that afternoon. They wanted me to go to an AA meeting that evening, but I said, no way. First, I have to read this book. And when I've read and studied this book, then I will be prepared to go to an AA meeting, and I'll go. Because I didn't know anything about AA. I knew absolutely nothing about it. The reason I didn't know anything about it is whenever the question of alcoholics or alcoholism came up anywhere, I turned it off. I wasn't interested in hearing about that stuff. So they kept talking, and they said, no, I think we go to a meeting tonight. So, man, I couldn't talk them out of it. I mean, they were going to drag me there, I think. So they picked out this meeting, and it was at a Lutheran church out in North Fresno. And I don't know that I recommend this for people for their first meeting, because it was a candlelight meeting. And I walked in there, you know, and all of these people are sitting around in the dark with candles in front of them. And I looked at these guys, and I looked at this bunch, and really and truly, what I was thinking of was the Ku Klux Klan. I'm thinking, this is really a weird bunch. But, you know, I couldn't get out of there. Anyway, I sat through that meeting. At the end of the meeting, they turned the lights on. And, you know, I was really surprised at what I saw. I saw a lot of really nice-looking people, men and women. They just looked nice. They had smiles on their faces. They had all said that they were alcoholics, and yet they seemed perfectly comfortable with the whole deal. And I wasn't comfortable at all. Not at all. I thought this was pretty much the end of the road for me. I thought that I was between a rock and a hard pan. I figured, you know, I'm not going to live if I keep drinking, but I can't live without drinking. I mean, there's no answer for me. And so, I don't remember one word that was said at that first AA meeting I went to. I don't remember anything, but I do remember the people. And just looking at them, I could not believe that there were all of these people who said they were alcoholics, and yet they looked fine, and they were laughing, and they were having a good time. So I went back to another meeting, and whatever. But, you know, those first few days are tough, and I think the first words that really caught my attention were "one day at a time." Because I had always figured I had to make this momentous decision that today I'm going to quit drinking for the rest of my life. And that's something I couldn't deal with. I couldn't handle that. This idea of just not drinking one day at a time sounded like, you know, that's within the realm of possibility. I'm willing to try that. So boy, I white-knuckled it out there for 8 or 10 days, and I was going to meetings every other night. I got to my first, second Saturday night, and I was ready to give up. And I had a list of phone numbers and names, and I started going down this list, and I finally found a fellow at home, and I talked to him. And this was right at dinner time on Saturday night, and I knew I was interrupting his dinner. But I told him I was in such a state of depression, I didn't know any way out of it but to drink. I didn't have any answers. And he told me two things that I will never forget. First of all, he said, your depression is your head trying to give you an excuse to drink. But he said, your head can't make you drink. The only way you can have a drink is by using your arm You've got to reach out somewhere and pick up a glass that has booze in it. And if you do that, you'll drink. But your head can't make you drink. Well, that kind of made sense, too. We had this long conversation, 45 minutes. And at the end of the conversation, he thanked me for calling. And at that point in my life, I really will say those were the kindest words I had ever heard. I could not imagine someone interrupting your dinner for 45 minutes and then thanking you for calling. I was overwhelmed by that. Well, I can report to you that phone call with that fellow ended up being my sponsor. And probably the best friend I've ever had in my life, without question. I then started, you know, trying to work this program, working with a sponsor. I was told you have to change your whole way of thinking. Well, you know, at the time I was 57 years old, and to tell somebody 57 years old to change their way of thinking is not very easy. I figured, you know, people 25 ought to be able to do that, but not somebody 57. So I rebelled at that a lot, and I remember telling my sponsor very early on that I only need you for one thing. I need you to show me how not to drink. As far as living is concerned, I don't need you. I know all about living. Well, you who have been around this program a while know that he laughed when he heard me say that. He laughed at that one. Because, you know, it is simply not true. The steps of this program can help a person change his whole way of thinking. And, I'm so grateful that I don't have to drink as of today, and it's been quite a period of time now. But I'm so grateful for all the other things I've been taught about living. I mean, really neat stuff. For example, honesty. I never realized that being dishonest was basically the root of most problems that we have in our lives. You know, if you're absolutely honest with people and everything is above board, you don't get into many difficulties. You don't get into many jams. You don't have to lie your way out of things. And so the honesty that I've been taught in this program as one of the basic fundamentals of it really is a great thing. Now, I gotta tell you, I'm not perfect in that respect. No way. I did something today that is as dishonest as you can get. I forged a guy's signature. In my head, it's not a very important document, so it's okay. But I know I'm going to have to fess up about this. Anyway, you know, we do the best we can. That's all the angels can do. Another thing, I had never been taught to think about motives. When you're going to do something or when you're going to make a decision, to examine your motives. I never did that. I made decisions based on just whims, what I thought was going to look good, what I thought was going to make me look good, without really looking into what the facts were and what my motives were. In the first year that I was sober, I made an investment that turned out to be a financial disaster. This is before my sponsor had told me about looking into your motives, so it's his fault. But My motives in making that investment were so bad that it should have gone sour. I deserved it, without question. I did this thing from a totally ego viewpoint, building up my ego. If this thing went, I was really going to look great. So I, as a result of that lesson, I really now try to examine my motives when decisions have to be made. The other thing I never understood before was this question of feelings. I never understood that I was in charge of my own feelings. I thought my feelings were all reactions to you. And what I know now, and what I try to practice on a daily basis, is this, that I am in charge of my own feelings. If you all start booing right now and walk out of the room, it's okay with me. You're not going to hurt my feelings. Because I'm not going to give you the power to hurt my feelings. It's my choice. I get to do what I want. Now, if somebody I think harms me, I can get mad about it. And if I do that, then what this program has taught me is I better do an inventory and figure out how I was wrong. They harmed me, but what did I do? And this is something else about living that never occurred to me. The idea of finding out how I was wrong in a situation. I had this come up with my sponsor about 4 years ago. You know, he told me a little lie, and he cheated me out of $7.50. And I discovered it. And I will tell you that I was crushed, angry, hurt, mad. I was every word in the book. This was something a sponsor would never do. Well, you know what my problem was? I had this person up on a pedestal there. You know, I had him up there where he was absolutely a faultless, perfect person. And that wasn't fair to him because he isn't a faultless, perfect person. Heck of a good sponsor. I probably worked 4 months on an inventory of that situation to come up finally with how I was wrong. Secondly, he showed me how amends work perfectly because he made his amends to me. He gave me back the $7.50 and he displayed exactly how amends are supposed to be made. And that taught me a lot. This situation with him was probably the greatest learning experience I've had in this program. At the time, it was killing me, just killing me. But as it all worked out, it was a wonderful learning experience. So I don't know, you know, I come to these meetings and I'm here tonight because I truly believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous offers the only solution in this world for a drunk like me and probably drunks like you. I don't think there's any other place to go. I can't say that I tried them all, but I have a brother who has been through 7 treatment centers and he's drinking today. He won't follow it up with this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had another brother who died of a combination of alcoholism and a manic depressive mind. He didn't die, he committed suicide. He died, but that was the manner in which he died. So, you know, I see this in my family. How the program of Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't worked for either of my brothers. So far to this day, it's working for me. and I just don't think I've got any other place to go. Now, I don't say that I absolutely love every meeting I go to, and I don't always love everything I hear. But most of the time when I go to a meeting, I hear something I needed to hear, and sometimes from people I don't even know, I've never seen them before, but they come up with something I really needed to hear. And I also learned from my sponsor early on about this word commitments, and he's told me you have to go to 3 committed meetings a week. And you show up at those meetings come hell or high water. So I've tried to do that. And I think that's a very good plan for me. I hope it is for other people too. Without commitment meetings, I used to sit home, say, oh, shall I go to a meeting tonight? Shall I not go to a meeting? Shall I go to this meeting? Shall I go to that meeting? Well, all of that indecision goes by the board when you've got commitment meetings. I mean, that's on Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday, that's where I am. Makes it pretty easy. And you know, I like the fellowship in AA. I've got some really nice friends I've made here. Some I knew before. A lot I didn't know till I got involved in this program. It's a selfish program. I come here and talk tonight. I'm doing this for me. Anything that I do in the way of service in AA, and I do very little, but I'm doing it for myself because it helps me stay sober. And I think a real turning point in sobriety was when I became a secretary of a meeting when I was 6 months sober. When I got that job, that's when I really started feeling a part of AA. Really getting to know people and associating with them. And it changed everything. That 6 month period when I accepted being a secretary. Menial task, but for an arrogant person like me, that's the type of things I need to do. That gets me back where I ought to be. It's a neat program. I hope newcomers will keep coming back. I'm just so grateful to be alive. I feel sure that I would not be alive today were it not for this program. I don't think I could have lived through any more of those accidents of the type I had. I don't think I had another chance coming. I still don't think I have another chance coming. And I hope I always think that way. I don't ever want to think I'm well. That's a real dangerous idea. I have days when I get a little iffy in that respect, but I don't ever want to think I'm well, because if I do, I know I'm in big trouble. I keep hearing about in AA, there are a lot of people here who have 1 to 5 years of sobriety, and there's a lot of people here that have more than 10, but there's very few that are between 5 and 10. Well, that's where I am. I hope I'm going to prove those people wrong, that 5 and 10 years will go by quickly and I'll still be sober. And you know, with the help of you people and this program and my sponsor, and if I stay in service and do what I can, God willing, I can't give myself the credit, it's all up to Him. God willing, I'll be sober the rest of my life. Thanks for letting me be here.